Thank you. these conversations about gentrification. Like I've said before, if you guys hold in skinny bikes or skinny bikes,
so that it protected the interests of the richest and most powerful people and prevented business regulation.
Attack on unions, certainly the most serious attack on the core.
can still get all the benefits they bargain for. The union has to bargain on your behalf. In many cases, unions will also, as you know, in order to reimburse themselves for the cost of bargaining for people who aren't members, they will collect what are called agency fees for those folks. And that's just to reimburse them for the cost of, you know, hiring the lawyers and doing all the stuff you have to do to collectively bargain. The problem is if unions are not allowed to charge these fees, is that all of a sudden you get all the benefits of being in a union, but you don't necessarily have to pay a thing. So people quit the union because they're getting all the benefits, whether they're in it or not, and then eventually the union doesn't have enough money to perform its basic functions, and the union collapses, and then no one gets any of the benefits.
So essentially, it creates a short-term free-riding problem that's in a long-term destruction of unions.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's about. I mean, this is the same thing. You know, you sometimes hear the term right-to-work laws. It's one of the most misnamed terms you'll ever hear. Is exactly what I just described. It is a law that says that unions are not allowed to charge these agency fees, so non-members can get all the benefits of being in the union without actually having to, you know, to pay anything in return. I should note that union fees generally are a tiny fraction of the benefits of being in a union. You know, the average unionized worker earns, I believe, it's about 12% more than a similarly situated non-unionized worker. I am actually in a union. My union dues are a percentage of a half of my wages. So, if I had paid agency fees, I'm a member, but if I pay agency fees, it would be the same amount. So, generally speaking, you get a whole lot more for being in a union than you pay in the agency fees. These fees are just there to make the union viable. And if you take those away, whether through the so-called right-to-work laws or through this Friedrichs case, that's seeking to essentially impose a right-to-work regime on every public sector union in the country, then you're eventually going to gut many of these unions' ability to function because it's going to be very hard for them to have enough money to operate.
So while it's largely being disguised as kind of a freedom of speech battle, I'm seeing that workers should be able to, you know, spend their money how they see fit if they don't want to participate in a union. But really what's at the heart of it is that people are going to get worse wages as a result, and there's just a long-term benefit that are really startling. And the thing that I think gave me the most pause when I was researching this was it's largely funded by the Koch brothers. But I feel like when you see that, that's your huge red flag, that this is probably something not good.
This particular case isn't brought by this group, but there were two predecessor cases that laid much of the groundwork for it that were brought by the National Right to Work Legal Committee, which is probably the leading anti-union litigation shop out there. This one's being argued by this lawyer, Michael Carvin, who last time on Buffy the Vampire Slayer was seen trying to kill the Affordable Care Act. He's a reoccurring villain. It's a troubling case. They were really creative legal theory. I mean, you alluded to it, it's a free speech type case.
It's creative. It's also, it's sort of intuitively appealing. Right? I mean, that's part of what's so suave about it.
Yes.
If you don't actually know much about this, but you hear just the thumbnail sketch and someone says, no, that's a violation of free speech, I think a lot of people might sort of instinctively go, oh man, that's a terrible thing. People should be free to do what they want to do.
Yeah. So the theory behind it is that unions engage in a conversation with employers. I mean, what unions do is they sit down and they bargain with the employer, and that requires speech. And so the theory is that if you object to what the union is doing, you shouldn't be required to pay these agency fees that then fund speech that you might disagree with. So that's the idea behind it as a free speech case. The problem with that is that if you take that view seriously, I don't see how you can have any regulation of the workplace. When I was hired at CAP, I sat down with the woman who was then our de facto HR director, and we had a conversation, and she said, like, we would like to pay you this much money, and I came back with a certain another number, and we I went through the same hiring process that most people go through when they're hired for of speech. But if all of a sudden that means they're unconstitutional under the First Amendment, that means we really can't have any kind of regulation of the workplace at all. And America becomes a pretty nasty place pretty quickly.
Is that what this case is about? Is this using collective bargaining as sort of the first chip away at any level of regulations or constraints on business?
It's a good question. I mean, anti-union groups have wanted to chip away at these agencies for a really long time. And there's a case called Abood, I believe, from the 1980s, where they challenged, you know, it was basically the same case, where they brought a challenge to these agencies and they lost. And now we have a much more conservative Supreme Court that think they can win this time around. And unfortunately, there's a good likelihood they will win, given the court that we have. This attack on unions has been around for a while. Now, that said, there are certainly elements within the highest levels of the legal profession. There's a gentleman appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court today who thinks that most of our labor laws, including minimum wage laws, the maximum hour laws, the laws protecting the right to organize, are unconstitutional. So there are people at very high levels who want to go there. Most of them don't want to do it through the First Amendment, but I'm sure if they got that, they'd be happy to take it.
When do you think a lot of the political opposition to, even having a freaking minimum wage, right, which, serious political candidates for, president on one side of the aisle actually have said out loud, seriously, right? I mean, maybe that's not crazy to contemplate. I know we have a lot more cases we want to talk through, but thank you for that with Friedrich, because I personally now understand this a little lot more. So there's another piece that we would love to sort of have you help us understand, and that's the coal case coming out of Texas. What's that one about?
Yeah, I mean, this could really be the curve of the uterus, because there are just two huge reproductive justice cases. Potentially, I don't think the court is likely to write the words, therefore Roe v. Wade is overruled in their opinion. But if Texas wins, if their law is upheld, and then the abortion clinic loses, then it could have the same practical effect as if Roe v. Wade were overruled. So the idea behind this law in Cole, it is two provisions of Texas's anti-abortion law that are challenged. The first deals with what are called admitting privileges. So if you're a physician who performs abortion in Texas, you have to have the right to sign patients admit patients into a hospital that is sufficiently nearby, I believe it's within 30 miles or something like that. And the second is that it's called an ambulatory surgical center requirement. What that translates as, for the most part, is that if you want to operate an abortion clinic, you have to have to comply with very expensive architectural rules. And those rules normally apply to places that perform, often very major surgeries. The problem with both of these laws is if you look at them on their face, they look like they're health laws. So there's some intuitive sense to, okay, well, I want a doctor who can check me into this hospital in case I need to, and abortion, it sounds like a surgery, and so, we want to have a coordinated facility that's built for that. When you dig down really just an inch below the surface, it becomes clear that they're shams. So, there's an emergency room because you don't need to have a previous relationship with the doctor who has the many privileges at that hospital in order to get administered into the hospital. You show up. If there's another doctor who's treating in the emergency room, doctor will call your doctor. And abortions have an incredibly low rate of complications. And in fact, one of the reasons why doctors have trouble getting admitting privileges to perform abortions is because if they are primarily what their practice is, complications are so low. And hospitals generally require you to actually admit a certain number of people in order to get privileges, and they can't meet their quota because they don't have enough patients to be admitted to the hospital. The same thing's true with the ambulatory surgical centers. There are many clinics that just
talking to a reproductive justice activist recently. She's one of their conservative leaders who's saying, well, you know, if people are concerned about women actually getting access to a clinic, they can go across the board into different states. So that's an admission that you're not really concerned about whether you're getting safe access to abortion if you're just saying the woman in the state will want here for political reasons.
It's an admission that they're trying to shut down.
That's how they decide about it. Chances are, I mean, you referenced Roe v. Wade, and we have laws on the books that are protecting women's rights, but murders continue. You know, we see laws like this in Texas that are chipping away. Why isn't this a no-brainer that this shouldn't be seen by the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very clever case. It's a very clever law, because, I mean, like I said, it sure looks like an outfall. And the problem is that if this thing is upheld, and this is why I said that this endangers Roe, if you pass these sham health laws to just put expensive burden on top of clinics, you know, what's to say that state can't say, okay, doctors can't perform an abortion unless they complete a 100,000-hour training course that is taught by the Pope? Justice Kennedy did initially vote to strike down the Texas policy, and then he was convinced to sort of back off and Senate now to a really conservative lower court. So I suspect what was going on is that he thought they were going to kill it for him, and then they didn't. And a oral argument in this case, the second time around, he seemed to be floated that he might want to say that to the lower court again. What was he going on with Kennedy? Is he really wants to kill affirmative action, but he doesn't want to be the one to do it? So he keeps trying to give him someone else and hope that they will do it for him.
Well, moving back to my women's rights, I think we're going to move back to Black Twitter. This is the scary immigration case.
Yeah, I mean, this is immigration and nearly 5 million undocumented people are going to get temporary status, whether they're able to stay here, and I shouldn't say status, but like, you know, technically temporary instructions that they could stay here and they wouldn't be deported and they could work.
That would be
correct. And almost immediately, a bunch of conservative led states filed this lawsuit. They went to this document, be the most anti-immigrant judge in the country. And goddamn, it's just extraordinary what the length that they went to wind up in this judge's courtroom. The case is with the trial was in Brownsville, Texas. To give you an idea of what that means, the Attorney General's office is in Austin, which is mainly centered in the state of Texas. Brownsville's here, that little tip right at the bottom of Texas, where you go any further here in Mexico. That's what they drove the complaint all that distance, so that they could get in this judge's court, because they were so certain that he would give them what they wanted, and he gave them what they wanted. He suspended the entire program. They appealed it to a court of appeals. It wound up twice in front of an extraordinarily conservative panel. And so they're in the unusual position where now it's in front of the Supreme Court, and this is the most liberal panel of judges that has ever heard this case. The issue here is whether or not President Obama had the authority to create this program absent a new act of Congress. And there's a lot of things on his side saying that he does. I mean, a lot of this is just what's called prosecutorial discretion. The executive branch gets to decide which laws they enforce and how they enforce it. In the case of immigration laws, Congress only funds a tiny percentage of the amount of money you need to deport everyone who's undocumented in this country. And so the executive branch has to pick and choose. And so this is just the president being transparent about who they're making these choices. There's also Reagan-era regulation saying that if the president grants you a deferred action, that you are entitled to work. And so they are challenging effectively what Reagan has been doing. This rule has been in place since the Reagan years. So I'm cautiously optimistic about this. On the left hand, there was a major immigration case in front of the Supreme Court. Robertson Kennedy hinted that something like this is legal. But we won't know for sure until probably June.
Are there any other cases in our last minute that we should know about what would be ill and individuals here that you would be embarrassed to know if we didn't know about these cases?
I'm going to talk about one more case. I hope
maybe you're embarrassed to know what's going on.
Just spread it out.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back. It is the first Weekly Worst of 2016. I've been here right since 2016 started. In studio with us, we have Alan Pike, our dear friend, and one of our favorite reporters ever, but also from Think Progress, Tracy District, here off right. Really mean mostly for my benefit how we can work this world. Yes.
We send iPads to fix the test scores, and then special finger gloves to fix the broken iPads.
$1,000 on nights where they would be arrested for blasphemy if they say that's fine. What Cuomo's doing is sort of like a mean cousin of that, like evil twin of this. Like I was speaking to my colleague, Brett Colbert, that I did some reporting on this. And in the process, looked at Maria Fosterkinis, sorry, Maria, if I butchered that, the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, who pointed out, quote, these are not the people need to be forced to accept help. The problem is that help is not available.
So it's a mandate by Christian Chalker Mistress. It's an unfunded mandate. For now. equation. It's complicated, but this is not the way to go about it.
And the way in which it is simple is that it all comes back to resources, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's how it works. If there was a right amount of resources in these systems, then these kinds of technical procedural fights would be much less damaging. They would still matter, but they would be much, much, much less damaging.
That's too damn high, Alan. What else do you have?
Lots of people were paying very close attention to what was happening in Detroit. And just took a lot of eyes off it. And I'm
part of the weekly worst. I'm actually just going to go ahead and vote for that one. I'm currently drinking for the My Detroit mug. I know it's a city that I care of for a variety of reasons, and this is just as someone who really closely follows urban issues. The things that have been going on in Detroit, there's always reason that you want hope and you want this city to succeed because it makes so much, I think, to American workers, to African Americans. There's almost like this cold war around Detroit, and to see what has been going through is kind of a puzzling thing for urbanists. But with this particular issue, it's mind-boggling. It's terrifying because the people that are going to pay the price are going to be students, particularly poor people, because they have fewer alternatives when it comes to educating their children. And this story is actually making me really sad, and this is my vote for weekly worst.
Of course, these are the same poor kids who are slowly being led poisoned into my glass of water and our home and can't afford to buy that bottle of water as an alternative to get rid of my store in Flint or something.
That's not different.
Sure.
I can point out my geographical understanding.
I was trying to put the youth on the sense to sort of be lavish in your civic planning, and a lot of what probably needs to happen for these longer term structural financial issues in Detroit and the area surrounding it to get on a sustainable path and not just sort of bounce from crisis to crisis like we're seeing with this public health story, is a pretty radical and major physical restructuring of the physical infrastructure of these cities. And they have to contract so that they are appropriately organized and sized for the current populations that live there, and that will put them in a position to potentially expand in the future. But you gotta kind of, in that sense, you gotta kind of get it better.
Absolutely. A planned shrinkage, as urban planners discuss. And it's hard to execute it because that's a term that has been used for.
Segment
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us on Thursdays at 4 p.m. East, 1 p.m. West on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also find us on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. East, 8 a.m. West on the Progressive Voices Network using the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes, and don't forget to leave us a rating. Feel free to pitch us on Twitter via the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org.
See you next week.